Welcome to Included, the Disability Equity Podcast, brought to you by the Johns Hopkins University Disability Health Research Center. This podcast challenges stereotypes of disability by sharing stories, data, and news. Each season digs deep into topics, offering multiple perspectives, and will expand your view of disability. We are your hosts. I'm Bonnie Lynn Sweenor, Director of the Johns Hopkins Disability Health Research Center.
And I'm Nick Reed, Assistant Professor at Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Scott Landis is an Associate Professor of Sociology at Syracuse University. Informed by his interest in medical sociology, aging in the life course, and disability theory, the majority of his research focuses on health and mortality trends across the life course for those with developmental disability and for veterans. His other primary research focus addresses the intersections of intellectual disability and social theory. Dr. Landis has recently published multiple research articles characterizing the greater risk of poorer COVID-19 outcomes faced by people with intellectual and developmental disability. His work highlights the vulnerability of this group during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Landis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I first want to start with thank you for this work, which we at the Disability Health Research Center at Johns Hopkins think is so important and central to guiding policy. And before we really dig in, I wanted to ask if we can start with talking about data, which was one of our favorite topics on this podcast. We found it difficult to find data sets that capture disability appropriately, particularly in this time of COVID, I would add. Can you comment on if disability is underrepresented in health data and what we could do to address that issue?
I think the short answer is absolutely yes, emphatically. And this was a pre-COVID concern, I'm sure that you shared, is that we just do not engage in adequate health surveillance of people with any type of disability in the United States. Other countries do a better job than we do, but we, in my mind, have failed miserably in this area. A lot of my career has been trying to find data sources that I can utilize in order to examine health outcomes, specifically for people with intellectual and developmental disability. And there are some. The National Health Interview Survey, in particular, I think, historically did a better job than many other surveys, including disability questions, with one particular question about intellectual disability. Unfortunately, due to budget cuts, they've changed their survey and dropped that question. I know many of us advocated for that not to be the case, but my understanding is they still chose to do so. There are other surveys, ACS, the American Community Survey, the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance, the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey, that do ask disability questions and allow for some semblance of a nationally representative sample, and I think have been useful. However, there's a problem if we're particularly talking about intellectual and developmental disability that these nationally representative surveys have tended to adopt the Washington Group questions, which I, just to be honest, am a big critic of, because there's six questions within the Washington Group questions that get at hearing disability, vision disability, physical disability. But the question that would include people with intellectual disability is something to the effect of, do you have difficulty concentrating or remembering? Which might be people with Alzheimer's disease, might be people with later onset dementia. And so it's hard to really separate out who is being captured in that data question. So I think two levels to answer your question. One, yes, this is an issue where we in the US aren't doing good data collection on people with disability in general. It's even worse for those with intellectual and developmental disability. And then to the third part of your question, Bonnie, it's been so obvious during the pandemic how this can really lead to negative outcomes. Because in my mind, it's not the only thing that drives policy, but much policy is informed by data. And if you don't have proper data on a population, you policymakers kind of are there with their hands up in the air saying, well, what do we do? We don't really know what's going on. The CDC did not until later in the pandemic even begin collecting basic demographic data on COVID-positive patients. such as even age and race, ethnicity, and gender, things that we would think are basic. And so I think there has been some effort to possibly try to capture disability status, but it's not been thorough and it's not actually been effective. And so we're left with what you see in a lot of our papers, where we're really trying to find data sets that are not typically looked at when we're doing health surveillance.
I think the latter point you're making is really poignant. And I think we should just reemphasize that a lot of the data sets you're talking about, the nationally representative surveys, we don't get those until almost a year delay, at least, to inform policy in a public health crisis like this. There was no at the beginning of the crisis, and there still is sort of a haphazard surveillance method where we actually collect these demographic variables that would allow us to inform policy and allocate resources sort of appropriately. So it's a real problem.
And the, you know, the frustrating thing there, Nick, is that I remember early in the pandemic talking to a leader at the CDC who has some say over death certificate data and when it drops. Because I spend a lot of my time with death certificate data, and it's typically, like you're saying, 2 years past event before we can even see the initial data. However, the CDC does have the ability to drop data early if they deem it a significant population, substantial population, sometimes they'll say, and it's necessary for the good of the public health. And I, early in the pandemic, was repeatedly talking to folks there saying, this is the case. This group is not going to do as well during the pandemic. It really would benefit us to see this data early. And they said, well, there's just not enough cases. It's not a sizable enough population within the US. We don't think we can justify doing so. And I don't know what to say to that, because to me, that is not a substantial argument and not justification. But so yeah, I think the data, that's one of the frustrating things, is in some instances, the data is there, but the systems that are in place don't allow access to it until, like you're saying, such a late point in time that it's not going to be as informative.
That is extremely frustrating. So this question is for the researchers, I think, in our audience. You know, in your pieces, you've used data sets that Bonnie and I are actually not familiar with, and they're a little bit more rare. And I think that's because they've appealed to the narrowness of your work and what we just talked about, the fact that there aren't many data sets out there. Can you tell us a little bit about these data sets and sort of why they did appeal to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. It dovetails exactly with the prior discussion about, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, well, even now, when we were looking around, and we had put a couple of reports out saying we think there's going to be concern based on our earlier research. And so we were really scrounging around trying to find what data can we utilize in order to even try to address this topic. The first paper, and I acknowledge one of my colleagues who I work with on most of these is Dr. Margaret Turk at Upstate Medical Center. Upstate Medical Center, where Dr. Turk and also Margaret from Mica on that paper, where they both are, is part of the Trinetics network. And Trinetics is it's like a federated consortium of, I think it's 42 to 48 medical providers. They talk about being global. I think 80% of the providers are in the United States though. And they're typically university-based hospital systems or medical schools that buy into the Trinetics network. And as part of doing so, they submit real-time electronic medical records to Trinetics. But as part of the process is as a submitter, you also then get access to these real-time de-identified electronic medical records for everybody within this consortium. And so we use that on an initial paper and actually are just getting back to it with a follow-up paper. The first one we use, they've got two networks. Trinetics has a COVID research platform that is specifically just devoted to patients who are diagnosed as COVID positive. But then they also have a broader research platform that includes COVID-19 patients, but also includes patients who were never diagnosed with it. So our first paper, we used, like I said, the COVID platform. And at the time, this was May, I think if I recall correctly, we were doing this paper. There were about 30,000 patients within the Trinetics platform who had a positive COVID-19 lab-based confirmed positive COVID-19 diagnosis. And so in that paper, we were able to look at case fatality being the number of deaths that have occurred within the population that has been diagnosed as COVID positive. So your numerator is deaths, your denominator is cases, positive cases, and compare case fatality rates between people with and without intellectual and developmental disability. What we found in that study is that the case fatality rates were indeed higher for people with intellectual and developmental disability, but only at younger ages, under the age of 74. Once you got to 75 and above, similar case fatality rates, which I think makes sense to me if we think about heterogeneity, frailty, that a lot of people with more severe medical conditions die at an earlier age, so that when you get to older age groups, there's a lot of similarities more than differences between those with and without intellectual and developmental disability. So that's the first one, Trinetics. Our other two papers, I mean, the second one to me is extremely unique because we actually were, after we published the Trinetics paper, about that time, we were contacted by a group called New York Disability Advocates, which is a consortium of 100 and something providers around the state of New York who provide 50% of the residential group home capacity for the state. And they actually, to me, were very progressive as providers in saying, look, we know the data is going to be extremely important to understand what's going on. We are not certain that this data that is being collected by the state will be shared in such a way that we can use it to help guide our decision making. So we are taking it upon ourselves to do a weekly survey of our providers. And are asking whether you'd be able to come on board to help guide us in the data collection and then the analysis. And actually, to me, we're not only very progressive, but courageous to say we're willing to then hand you the data and you do what you want. And we're not going to take any, you know, they didn't want final decision what's published. They said, just publish what's happening, if whatever it might be, because we think this has to get out there. And so I've worked with New York Disability Advocates now. We're going into 10, 11 months where they do this weekly survey. We've been tracking 63 of their providers every week for the past 10 months, data collection and then cleaning it. This specifically, we're looking at trends, both in cases and case fatality rates over time. And so like you're talking about, Nick, this is data that I don't think I ever would have even considered prior to the pandemic, because I tend to dwell in the world of nationally representative data. But I got asked this question by a colleague. They were like, are you not concerned that the data you're utilizing is biased and that you would be better waiting until representative data is available? And what I said was, I think I would take that stance if this were not a crisis and people weren't dying, especially at a disproportionate rate. But in times of crisis, you've got to take on strategies that are unique and different in order to really understand what's going on. And we try to admit in every work the limitations that are there, but what we have clearly shown within the NIDA data is that the case rate in these group homes is trending between about 3.5 to 4 times higher than the general population. And the case fatality rate is staying consistently between 1.9 and 2.5 times higher than we're seeing in the New York general population. And now take it just real quickly to our third set of data where we jumped in California. Is actually among all the states doing the best job of sharing data. Their developmental disability service system is publicly sharing. They drop maybe weekly data where they provide cases and deaths for all people receiving IDD services across the states. And they do it by type of service received. Because the question we were at by the time we hit the California data is, okay, we've established that there's disproportionate outcomes. Are they consistent across the board or do they vary by residential setting? And in the California data, what we were able to show was going on in California is that the case rate was lower for people with IDD than for the state overall. When you consider people with IDD as one homogenous population, the case fatality rate was higher than the state. However, when we broke it down by where people lived, really told a different story. People with intellectual and developmental disability living in their own or family home, so possibly less staff interaction, people coming in and out of the house, had a case rate that was lower than the state. So the spread of the virus wasn't as advanced among people living in their own or family home, which makes sense. And their case fatality rate was slightly higher than the state, about 1.5 times higher, but not substantially higher. Different story among people living in congregate settings, which is what we would expect. People living in congregate settings with more residents had a case rate that was much higher than the state. Sometimes 5, 6, 10 times higher. And it really depended on the amount of residents per setting. people living in a type of residence that provided 24-hour nursing care, indicating more medical need, had a much higher case fatality rate, which to me is just so logical. Spread is about the density of the setting, how many people are there. And fatality, like we see in the general population, is very much about pre-existing conditions and medical need. And so, yeah, I think all these data sets are unique in their own way. All are data sets that, like I stated, I don't know that I would have considered prior to the pandemic, but all, in my opinion, are helping give us a different piece of the puzzle as we try to understand exactly what might be going on.
So why do you think COVID-19 could possibly present a greater risk to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, particularly in residential facilities? I mean, you just spoke a little bit about that and you just reviewed the data amazingly succinctly for a podcast, which we always acknowledge is really hard to do. You know, what could be the reasons?
That's a great question. I'm working on a couple of studies now, Bonnie, that we're trying to dig in deeper to understand specifically within these congregate residential settings, what might be going on or what might be driving rates. I mean, and this is what's being confirmed. Our suspicion going in were really three concerns. One would just be density of the living area. You know, it used to, I mean, back when I was doing direct services in this field, working with people with intellectual and developmental disability in Atlanta, a group home was capped at 4 residents. I mean, when we were closing institutions, that's what was going on. That was the ideal. And what's happened is as you've had budget cuts over the year, states have allowed more and more, to where in the state of New York, I know the average is 7, and a group home can go up to 15 to 16 residents, which is a lot of people in one home. And then you add in staff, you know, rotations on 8-hour shifts, and you, in a typical day, within some of these group homes, can have 20 people in a home. And at least, you know, 5 to 10 of them being people that are cycling into the home from outside, maybe even because of low pay, working 2 jobs. I know, especially within the city, talking to providers, a lot of their providers work second job at LaGuardia. And so you had people as staff that are coming in and out who we don't know their exposure to COVID. So I think number one is just shared space. You're sharing a bedroom, you're sharing a bathroom, you're sharing a kitchen, makes it really hard to socially distance. Number two, for some people with intellectual and developmental disability, social distancing just might not make sense. I mean, it's hard for us to understand. And so if you have some type of cognitive limitation, why do I have to wear this mask? Why? I mean, one thing I see most, I do it myself. My wife has really had to tell me not to do it. Well, if I've got a mask on, I'm about to sneeze. My tendency is to want to pull the mask off. You know, and then so just all these basic things that all of us have had to learn that have been kind of so different to us might be a little harder to understand. The other thing is there's some types of care, and I think many of us that don't need direct care don't realize this, that you can't socially distance. It's just impossible to do so. I mean, if someone needs help eating or bathing or just doing some of the basics, you're going to have people really close to you in such a way that it would be easier to spread the virus. So I think that's number one. I think number two is some of the policy decisions that were made in the states early on were detrimental. And I'm not trying to point a finger and give fault, because I think policymakers probably did the best they could in the midst of the situation that they really had no idea how to best handle it. But some of the policy decisions that did not provide I know in this state, the limitations in PPE, and that group homes were not seen as a priority setting for PPE, was really detrimental. I mean, when you had staff among group homes having to go door to door after work to ask neighbors, do you have any extra PPE? I need it for my job. I mean, that was just really an unfortunate situation. And I think, you know, obviously we can't talk about causality, but it seems like could have led to worse outcomes. I think the other thing, and we showed this in some prior work, and we're working on it more now, is typically, not always, but typically, individuals living in residential group homes, on average, have more medical needs than individuals that are not. I mean, that's just part of the nature of the service. That's one of the reasons a lot of times they're there. Not everybody. I mean, you've got some people living in group homes who don't have high medical need, but on average, people do. And so you necessarily, I think, have a setting that you're going to have more spread because of density, because of the difficulty social distancing, and because of more medical need. In my mind going in, we should have expected this. And our strategy should have been, okay, this is going to happen. What do we need to do to mitigate as much as possible? Where I felt like our strategy was, at least among policymakers, was, oh, really? You know, we didn't even think about this group, and that's always detrimental.
Yeah, I really agree with your last point there too, that we could have expected this going in. You've hit on a lot of topics, and I really, really just want to point out for our audience, your research is following like that traditional funnel where you went from the big picture and you're slowly telling us more and more at each level. And I think that's, it's like classic. It's exactly for any, maybe for any like student that's listening, this is like the perfect way you're supposed to do this, but you're doing it in real time too, where we're talking about the necessity to guide policy. And I'm really interested in, if you don't mind sharing with us, you know, what are you thinking about for next steps? And, you know, this is whatever you are willing to share. And also, what do we need to push policy further? Like you said, we could have expected this. There were certain things we could have known. And now we do know. Now we have some evidence. What else is out there, and how can we change policy?
Yeah, again, great questions. So to your first question about trajectory, the studies that we're just wrapping up now, and they should be out soon. So we had completed these initial studies. And to me, we established these poor outcomes among folks with intellectual and developmental disabilities, especially those in congregate settings. But the data was primarily the New York State data and the California data. So obviously the burning question is, okay, are these two states unique? We didn't think so, but can we find evidence that this is actually going on across the country? And so this a study that will be coming out soon. We've got data from 10 states, well, 9 states in DC on folks with intellectual and developmental disability. And they're consistently showing the same thing with case fatality rate. That for people living in congregate setting, across these 10 states, case fatality rate is about 3 times higher than the general population. The people living with intellectual and developmental disability in their own home or family home, case fatality rate about 1.5 times higher. To me, this is crucial, especially to the second point of your question about policy for vaccination prioritization. Because typically what we have seen so far is if, in the instances if, and I emphasize if, people with intellectual and developmental disability have received vaccination prioritization, it has typically only been for those in congregate settings and for their staff. And I highly support that. And I've advocated for it, and I applaud states that have done so. To me, it's short-sighted to only prioritize people in congregate settings, because what we're showing in this data, what the California data showed and what we're showing in this data, is that the risk of COVID-19 is still more severe for people with intellectual and developmental disability, even if they're not living in a congregate setting. So just blanket across the board, what we're arguing for is prioritization for everybody with intellectual and developmental disability, no matter where they're living and no matter the type of disability. That's the second piece that we're working on right now, is trying to understand differences in case fatality rate by type of disability. What we're finding is very similar to some of what's been published, where Down syndrome seems to be an indicator. And I applaud the CDC for recently indicating or listing Down syndrome as one of the conditions that can lead to more severe COVID outcomes. But what we're looking at and we'll be showing in this study is that it's not just Down syndrome, that while the risk related to Down syndrome seems to be more substantial than for other intellectual developmental disabilities, for all intellectual developmental disabilities across the board, there still is increased risk of COVID-19 death. And so I think going to the policy point of this question again, especially on vaccination prioritization, to me, this is integral at this point in time. You talked about what's needed. I mean, obviously as a quantitative person, the first thing I'm gonna go to is data, but we've already covered that pretty well. Data is being collected by states. To me, it needs to be shared publicly. There was an effort by Senators Murray, Hassan, and Warren during the latter part of the Trump administration. They wrote a letter to CMS, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, urging CMS to collect and publicly share data for people with intellectual and developmental disability. That, to my understanding, went nowhere. Hopefully, maybe that effort can be picked back up and the new administration would have a different perspective on that. I know that there's been some talks among HHS staff about data collection and sharing on this population, but and I don't want to be rude, and I'm an academic, I'm not a policymaker, I can say this, it's time to quit talking. I mean, it's time to do something. We know what needs to be done. We know the data is being collected. Can we not, even if it's not perfect, I mean, can we start at least sharing what data is out there? I think that would be key. You know, I think also for people that are listening that have it, I mean, we need advocates in key places. I mean, if you have connections with policymakers and politicians who have ability to influence decisions, they need to be informed. We need to be sharing this information and these stories as much as possible so that people who are making decisions actually have this information. And that's where I feel like we've tried to fit into what's going on, that we're trying to provide evidence so that people who are concerned, be it individuals with disability or parents or families or providers or policymakers, that they can have a report that says, look, we've got evidence that it's not going well for this population. And then I think, I mean, I applaud you, things like a podcast like you're doing that can get word out and say, look, this is important. You know, this is going on and you need to know about it. To me, everything seems small when we're doing it individually, but to me, all of us working together, we maybe can build enough of a wave that we can change some things. And it's changed, yes, now. And I don't want to be too pessimistic, but in some ways, what I have told others is it's too late in some instances to change the whole system such that we can fix it. We can't fix it during the pandemic. It's just not going to happen. But we've got to start the process, because is this the end of the pandemic? Is this the last pandemic? We just don't know. And I don't think if we're responsible, we can't be surprised again. The writing is on the wall. We've got to pay attention and say, okay, we know this is going on. We've got to really change the way that we do surveillance. I think the other thing that I've learned from this, and I encourage other researchers to consider it if they're so inclined to do so, is that there is data out there that we typically don't pay attention to. And there are individuals and providers out there. I was talking to a self-advocate the other day who's part of a group in Chicago of folks with disability who are collecting data themselves on the experiences of their peers and the population and what's going on during COVID. And it's not getting attention because they're not within the typical academic networks. And what I've learned from this, and where I think my growth is realizing that I need to be doing more collaboration with groups that are not within the mainstream of academia, but who have data that is not only just as valuable, but in some ways gives more insight than we have in our nationally representative data. And so maybe we can fill out the picture more by giving more robust consideration to the data that is out there and trying to figure out ways to include it within our research.
Thank you, Dr. Landis. I think that is the perfect way to end this conversation, in my mind, as a call to action for anyone who is tuning into this podcast, whether you're a stakeholder, researcher, advocate, family member, that we need to come together, particularly in this moment, to tackle these important issues, to do a better job, really, to work together. And I think that is the future. And so reach out to Dr. Landis, to us, to someone, and we will work hard to do the same, because we are all fighting this fight together. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, for the work that you're doing, which is truly incredible. And we look forward to your work, more of the same.
You have been listening to Included, the Disability Equity Podcast, brought to you by the Johns Hopkins Disability Health Research Center.
Thank you to our Included podcast team and everyone that made this podcast possible, especially Sabrina Epstein, Pratik Gajwani, Curtis Nishimoto, and our guests. Music is by Molly Joyce. This podcast is supported by a Johns Hopkins 10x20 Challenge Grant.